Hello, welcome to this edition of the REIT Report, Nareit's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Alan Kenny, and we're recording this on July 21st, 2017. My guest today for this special edition of the show is Ed Walter. Ed was named CEO of Host Hotels & Resorts, the largest hotel REIT in the world, in 2007. In the 10 years he was CEO, he oversaw a period in which Host completed more than $7 billion in deals. He also served as Nareit Chair in 2013. And he's now a member of the faculty in the real estate department at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. Ed's joining us today at Nareit's headquarters in Washington, D.C. to talk about the hotel business, what it's like running a company the size of Host Hotels, and REITs in real estate. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Alan, great to be here.
So, Ed, I want to take you back to REIT World a few years back. It's in San Francisco at Host-owned, I believe it's the Marriott there in San Francisco. And, you know, as part of Nareit, I was there a little bit earlier. The staff is all kind of running around because they know that you're coming. You get there, you walk in, they're all ready for you and everything. They're trying to put you up in a suite there in the hotel. And you say, you're like, no, just put me in a regular room. Well, I mean, you know, I guess, were you just looking for the extra revenue there from somebody else coming in?
Or? Yeah, look, if we can sell the room for more to somebody else, I was always a big fan of that. You know, at the end of the day, I'm supposed to produce earnings as a CEO, and anything that we can do to make that happen is I'm in favor of.
Fair enough. Well, you know, you came from, you know, I believe, you know, kind of a financial background, but what was the most important part of your background, do you think, when it came to, you know, running a hotel company?
You know, I think when you're running any kind of a company in a C-suite position, but especially in a CEO position, there's always a multitude of skills that are required to do that job. Now, clearly, as a hotel REIT, where we're investing in hotels, where, you know, the way we make money is by finding hotels to buy, look for ways to improve them, either by improving operations, investing capital in them so that they run better, generate better profits, or because they just grow because you've picked the right market and the market performs very well. A finance background is critical. You know, you need that type of a background to be comfortable in analyzing the potential investment. Because the REIT world, generally, we're required to distribute so much of our earnings or our taxable income every year, you're typically accessing outside capital in order to grow. So a financial background is really helpful for that. But beyond sort of those basic building blocks of the company, the other big area that you spend a lot of time on as a CEO of any company is focusing on strategy. And I think there, every element of a background can contribute to strategy, whether it's experience on the marketing side. I think my legal experience in some ways was helpful for that too. Because overall, when you're developing a strategy, you've got to bring all those different pieces of the puzzle to bear on deciding what your strategy is going to be. And you're really evaluating a lot of different elements of the economy and where the world is headed in order to craft the right type of a strategy.
You mentioned your legal background. Do you ever wish that you had stayed in law, or are you happy with the way it went?
No, absolutely not. You know, sure. I think a legal background is a great background for real estate. I think that in some ways, I remember talking to some of my classmates in law school in the early 80s, and we realized that I was using more of my legal courses, sort of securities law, tax law, property law, contract law. I was using a greater breadth of courses than any of them were, because they very quickly, when they went to work for a law firm, they were focusing on a much narrower discipline and becoming experts in an area where I was able to, in a sense, stay a generalist from a legal perspective. But I think it was pretty clear for me after my internships experience while I was in law school that I was more comfortable on the business side of the world than trying to play lawyer.
All right, a guest walks into a hotel. Tell me, I mean, what are the three most important parts of his or her experience?
You know, that's a great question, because I would tell you that during my 20 years in the business, the answer to that question evolved in a very significant way. When I first got to Host in the mid-1990s, all of the focus in the industry seemed to be around the hotel room. We would be continually told by our brand partners that the best place to invest was to improve the quality of the hotel room. And if you think back to the early 2000s, you had the heavenly bed, the heavenly shower. That's where all the focus, all the marketing, the advertising was all about what we're doing to the room. You know, in the middle of the decade, it started to turn into changing to flat panel TVs. And that was another way that you distinguished one room from another. I would tell you over the last decade that the focus has changed a lot. Now, part of that is probably because we've done so much in the room that it was hard to compete there. But I think what also changed, and some of this was maybe the rise of the millennials, but I would also tell you, I think a lot of this was just recognizing that when people traveled, they wanted more out of their travel experience than just staying in a hotel room. And what I'm getting at is the fact that there was a much more intense focus over the last 10 years on creating more of an experience throughout the hotel, but especially in the lobby. And if you think about that, that's really what a boutique hotel seeks to do. I mean, a boutique hotel in a lot of cases was really as much about the activity, the action in the bar or the restaurant on the first level, and tying the hotel into that, and trying to generate revenue by doing that, as opposed to just simply treating the lobby as a transition way to get the guests from walking in the front door to check in up into their room. And I think that's great, because I think that helps that notion of making the lobby and the other facilities or amenities that are part of that a more important part of the hotel experience. Helps make the hotel more memorable, makes the travel more fun, and that's what we want to do in our business.
How about bringing in people who might not necessarily be guests, but foot traffic for bars, restaurants, like you mentioned?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, the reality is people have a tendency to not want to use the hotel restaurant. You know, a lot of times you're shaking your head right now in a positive way that you sort of think about that. That's your last resort. I was always a big believer in the right locations, of finding a way to make our restaurant and our bar the choice of the customer, not the last choice of the customer. I wanted that to be their, in some ways, think of that as their first option. That might even be the reason why they come to the hotel, is they knew we had a good bar and a good restaurant. A lot of times the way to do that was to bring in somebody from the outside to run that F&B outlet. So, in some markets it might be a chain, but bringing in Gerber Restaurant Group to run the bars and the restaurants in some of our New York hotels, that was a very successful way to generate better revenue and hopefully generate better profits out of those spaces. And a lot of the way you're doing that is you're retaining your hotel guests, but more importantly, you're bringing in somebody from the outside too.
We're talking with Ed Walter, former CEO of Host Hotels and Resorts. So Ed, you had a long history with Host before you took over as CEO. Did you realize anything that really surprised you once you made that transition into the executive chair?
Well, when you look at that job from the outside, and having been a CFO and a COO, I think your initial sense is that, okay, well, I'm going to just be overseeing the people in the company that are doing the things that I used to do, but not having to necessarily get quite into the detail as much, because that was your perspective on the company. That's what you did before. Once you step into that job, you quickly realize how small a part of what you're going to do on kind of an every day or an every week basis really relates to the things that you did before. And frankly, that's important, because you want to make that change so that you start to do the CEO job as opposed to continue to be the CFO or the COO. So I think for me, stepping into the role, I found there were a couple of areas that I spent a lot more time on that I just hadn't appreciated watching Chris Nassetta be the CEO, only because he was doing it and we weren't as active in that area. And that's all the stuff that you do with the industry. So I think the CEO ends up being the primary spokesman for the company, not just with investors, but also with Congress, with other legislators, in industry gatherings and things like that. So if you think about all the big issues that have come up in the last decade, for the travel industry, the rise of Airbnb, for the real estate industry in general, all the challenges around renewing TRIA. labor issues in some markets, you know, all the tax issues that we're continually dealing with on the Hill even today, all those challenges take a fair amount of time, and those are issues that the CEO tends to be the primary spokesman for. So I hadn't really anticipated how much time was going to need to be spent on that, but I also found that to be one of the most enjoyable parts of the job.
Now, that's interesting because, as I mentioned, you were NARE chair in 2013. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, kind of getting into the industry part of things. I mean, there you're, you know, a really big face of the industry. I mean, you know, how did that really inform your perspective about REITs and real estate?
I would say, first off, that we are incredibly lucky as a REIT industry to have your team, you know, led by Steve and Tony, but, you know, there's a lot of depth that sits below that too, to represent us. You know, you have to, one of the things, my course at Georgetown is about REITs. Now, one of the things that I do when I start that course is I have the students sit through a 15-minute explanation of the legislative history of REITs. Now, that's probably not the part that they think is the most exciting, but if you've been part of our industry for a while, it's important. I think we all recognize that what was passed as part of the SCAR Act of 1960 that created the initial REIT and what that structure looks like today are two completely different animals. Yes, there are some significant similarities, but the evolution of our structure over 57 years now has been incredible. When the industry started, you couldn't manage your own product. Today, with a few exceptions, including the hotel business, you can. We've tweaked some of the rules around the ability to sell real estate. We've created the ability to have TRSs and have an ability to have small segments of operating businesses that weren't previously permitted to sit within our structure so that we could be maybe a little bit more diversified in terms of an economic animal. All of those little developments didn't just happen because Congress wanted to do it. Those happened because the industry stepped up and advocated for change to make our vehicle more akin to what the market wanted in terms of a real estate company. So I knew that before I stepped into the role, but what I was able to appreciate over the 4 years of leadership, culminating in being the chair in the last year, was both the strength of the team, also the commitment that our industry CEOs and other industry leaders have to what we do. I mean, as strong as our team is at NAREIT, they need the rest of the industry to be by their side in advocating for all the different issues that we advocate on. And I was always impressed with the willingness of our industry to step up and be part of that. So I think that's a big benefit. But it's we'll see what happens with tax reform. I suspect that there's clearly something that's going to happen there. We're going to need to show that same level of support for the team and the same level of activity going forward that we did in the past to make certain that tax reform goes our direction and not the reverse.
I'm always struck by just, like you mentioned, the kind of, esprit de corps, so to speak, you know, within the CEOs, you know, within the diverse sectors and all that. But you're right, there is this, you know, kind of real energy that they all bring to working together on a lot of these issues.
I think that's right. And it shows that we've always been able to get the industry leaders to step up and play a role. You know, when at the conferences, folks are attending those meetings, they're taking time away that they otherwise could be spent with shareholders. But, you know, I think everybody recognizes that for their period of time in service on the executive board or in the leadership team, that's an important thing for us to do. And I think that's why we've made the advances that we've made. I mean, if we hadn't passed the REIT Modernization Act, I think that was in 2000, I don't think the hotel industry would have been able to grow in the REIT world the way it has, because that inability to have it's a very technical issue, but the bottom line is that change allowed us to own 100% of the cash flow of our assets as opposed to trying to lease them to an outside party. And while that was able to be done initially in the 90s a bit, I don't think you could have had the growth that we had if you had to continue to try to deal with that particular issue. It just would have been too difficult to overcome. So it's a small example, it's a technical example, but I don't think Host or any of the other folks would have been anywhere near as big as they became if that issue hadn't been changed in 2000.
Who are some of the people in the world of business that you admire?
I sort of break that into a couple of categories. I would look at some of these folks like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk and say that I'm impressed with their vision. I'm impressed with their ability to think about whether it's a mundane thing like selling books and then watch that grow into selling everything, but their ability to look at some, or PayPal, pay, and change the way that happens, do that, take advantage of technology to deliver that in a way that becomes easier for the customer and then starts to change the business. I don't know that they ever thought those businesses were going to transform the way we live to the degree that they have, but they must have had a kernel of wisdom or a kernel of insight about what might be happening, and then they had the fortitude and the drive to actually make that business a reality, despite the fact that it might not have been profitable for a period of time, and grow it into something that, now you can look at, especially in the case of Amazon, you can look at that a little bit and say that's, you could say that's scary depending upon your perspective, right? I'd say in our industry, the person I'm most impressed with is Chris Nassetta. I've known him a long time. I've worked with him a lot. I think I know him incredibly well. But I thought he did a great job at Host as my predecessor. I think he's done an even better job at transforming Hilton. When he took over Hilton after Blackstone bought it, Hilton was an assemblage, but I don't think it was really a company. And Chris has done a lot of things at Hilton in terms of transforming it, but I don't think people think of it anymore as an assemblage. It's a unified international company that's growing at a very aggressive rate. And I think he deserves a lot of credit for taking that over at the beginning of the financial crisis, navigating through that, and turning Hilton into what it is today.
I mean, Chris Nassetta, he's a well-known figure in the industry. I mean, what was that like taking over for him? I mean, you mentioned he's obviously been a big influence on you. Was there any trepidation on your part, or I mean, were you ready to go?
It's always interesting to step into a situation when the prior person, guy or woman, has been as good as he was. I'd probably say in some ways for me, what was fortunate / unfortunate in addressing that was the fact that I took over at the end of 07. And while it's at this point you'd like to sort of forget all of this, the world was beginning to fall apart at the end of 07. We may not have realized it to the degree that we did 6 or 9 months later, probably about 6 months later in March when Bear went under. But in a lot of ways, whatever worries I had about matching what Chris Nassetta had done as I got into 2008 and really started my first full year as a CEO, were completely overcome by the fact that the Great Financial Recession was starting, and I had a lot of issues that I had to deal with that just became, okay, now that you're up to your up to your waist in alligators, let's start figuring out how you're going to get out of the swamp. And so that became the focal point.
That was obviously one challenge, but I mean, what do you think is the greatest challenge that you had in your career? I mean, is there anything that you wish you would have done or any regrets? I mean,
I think the biggest challenge, and especially in terms of my tenure as CEO, was navigating through that recession. Because while we started that period off with what we thought was a strong enough balance sheet, and it was at the time, I'm pretty certain it was the best balance sheet in at least the lodging REIT space, nobody had really anticipated that liquidity would dry up as rapidly and as comprehensively as it did. And so things that we just weren't accustomed to worrying about, which was refinancing a loan that was completely more than adequately secured, you know, or the ability to access the high yield market to do a new bond deal. You might not like the rate, but you generally could feel comfortable that you could get there, and then you could make a decision about whether the rate was accurate. All of a sudden, that was gone. And in that same environment, you know, so that's the whole REIT space. Now let's talk about the hotel space. Our president-elect starts to criticize companies for having group meetings in nice locations. Every CEO in America starts to figure, look at where they're having a meeting and trying to decide, do they want that fact, where their meeting is, on the front page of a paper? You know, the old front page test starts to apply to where your meetings are, because people saw what happened. I think it was Wells Fargo. You know, it started with AIG, with their incentive sales meeting, and then it went to Wells Fargo, which I believe was a meeting in Vegas. We owned the Ritz-Carlton in Naples. The spring is when that hotel makes all of its money. 21 out of 23 events booked for March of 2009, canceled. People left money on the table. They paid cancellation fees. We had booked that business at a point in time where we could get a very good cancellation fee. So it wasn't an economic decision in large part. It was essentially a decision that we don't want to run the risk of the publicity. And so you had that backdrop layering on with the weakening economy, layering on with weakening international travel. So at the end of the day, in the hotel space or at Host, we saw our EBITDA decline by more than 40% from 07 through the end of 09. And our debt, to my memory, didn't go down at all. Okay? So that was an interesting challenge. And the challenge around that is not just the math that I'm sort of implying by losing, you know, losing profits and still having to pay interest and to some extent a dividend. The challenge is that we couldn't even predict what the year was going to look like. You know, that's the problem of the hotel business, is you sell your rooms pretty much every night. So for about a 15-month period, every forecast that we got from our properties was worse than the last one. So, you know, it's sort of that concept of catching a falling knife, and we could never exactly figure out how far it was going to fall. So we had that challenge. So then you put yourself, you're a new CEO. Now you've got a good background in the company. That was fortunate. I mean, certainly with my prior roles, I had a very good understanding of the company as a whole and what made it tick. But I'm out in an environment that we've never really seen, because this was more dramatic in some ways than the declines that we saw in general in 01 to 03. Not quite as dramatic as what we saw after 9/11, but still the kind of the continuing fall off was pretty dramatic. I'm trying to explain that to investors. We're trying to explain that to the company. You know, you've got an entire workforce that doesn't necessarily see the full picture, but they can tell that things aren't good, and everybody's nervous about the ramification of that. And so, you know, I'd say that the reason why I look at that is probably the biggest challenge and also in a lot of ways the biggest success is the fact that at the end of the day, we communicated well through that, or as I think we did as well as anybody else. I think we also figured out how to not just climb into the foxhole and duck. You know, we looked for opportunities where we could take advantage of the dislocation in an intelligent way. And so a good example of that was we happened to have a convertible security that was coming due in, I think it was in the early 09. It was within an 18-month time frame. It was virtually our nearest term maturity. Well, hedge funds like to own convertible securities. Everybody was redeeming their hedge fund investments. So at that point in time, anything that the hedge fund could sell to deal with the redemption, they were happy to do. We were buying that debt of ours back. It was our nearest term maturity, and we were buying it at a 20 to 25% discount, turning something that was, we're generating 15 to 18% yields by virtue of doing that. So I think it's a small example, but it was a It's a good example of how when it gets a little bit ugly out there, if you can figure out what your priorities are, then you can figure out how to act on those in order to enhance your position. And I think collectively the different steps that we took, whether it was buying back debt at a discount, issuing a little bit of equity at the right time to stabilize the balance sheet and restore investors' confidence in the ability that companies were going to get through this whole time period, all of those steps were what put Host in the position to not only ride out the downturn, even in a volatile business that we were in, but to really position ourselves to outperform. And I think that's the steps that we took there were probably in a lot of ways the leading reason why, when you looked at the performance over the company while I was there, we were able to outperform the industry.
What was it like talking to investors then? I mean, what are those meetings like?
Well, you almost have to break that up into different time periods. You know, when it first got a little problematic, the stocks were falling because, in general, investors were concerned. But most people, I don't think anybody really envisioned where this was headed. So I can remember having conversations in the fall of 07, right about the time that I took over, where most of the discussion was, why aren't you buying stock back? Right? Because the stocks were cheaper than where they had been. Fast forward a little bit, you know, another 12 months later, that nobody's talking about stock buyback. They're starting to wonder what your liquidity profile is like. By the time you got to March of 09 at the Citi conference, which was one of the two conferences that actually did show up at Naples in March, there's a broader story with that, but one of the two that do. That I think most of us mark that as the bottom. The stock price is about bottomed at that point, but investors were just so shocked at how far stocks had fallen, and there was no visibility, especially across lodging, but really across most REIT sectors. Rents were dropping, NOIs were dropping, and people were not certain that they had a view on when the recovery could potentially start. And I think that was probably the most depressed group of investors I've ever talked to at that point in time. Now, what's interesting is 45 days later, after that conference, we were in the middle of something like 30 companies all doing secondary offerings of stock, and investors buying that stock on one day and finding that the stock traded higher the next day. So there was a huge run of successful secondary issuances that were all tied to dealing with near-term liquidity problems so that companies, investors could have a visibility that a company was going to get through the downturn. And ultimately, I think that started the recovery. So the stock started to recover well before NOI and revenue levels started to recover.
Well, now that you've been a member of the faculty at Georgetown for a few years, I mean, do you have any takeaways about how real estate is really taught as an academic discipline?
You know, the challenge that we have in teaching real estate in some ways relates to what comes next for these students, especially at the business school level. And what I mean by that is a lot of times folks that maybe come back to get a graduate degree and want to get an emphasis in real estate, they may be trying to change their career path a little bit. They maybe have been in another business and they want to try to get into real estate, and they're using their MBA education as a way to facilitate that transition. That's a good logical move. The challenge that we have is that not that many of our companies in the real estate business are that big that we have a lot of room within our company to bring in folks that don't have experience. And we tend to prefer people that have experience and have worked in real estate, you know, been through a cycle, but you have to have been in the business to understand how it works. So you got a little bit of a conundrum there. You've got an industry that typically wants to hire people with experience, and as an educator, you're attracting people who see an MBA or even an undergrad degree as a way to facilitate a transfer into the business. So part of you can address some of that through a summer internship, but let's face it, you know, a 75-day internship does not give you that much exposure to the business, so they're not necessarily going to solve it that way. So one of the hallmarks of our program at the Steer Center at McDonough Business School of Business as part of Georgetown University is to emphasize the practical and the experiential all the way through our curriculum. So what I mean by that is all of our courses have a practical element to where we're having people run an M&A model or, you know, work on Argus, learn how to use the tools that you're going to use later in our business. We have three or four different clinical programs, including an element of it where we actually will do feasibility analysis on transactions for a major investor, so that our students are getting an opportunity to actually be part of the business while they're going to school. And that doesn't mean we're neglecting the theory. I mean, part of the education process is to make certain that you're teaching the theory, and we do that. But we're also trying to make certain that when you walk out of that classroom, you could sit down in, you know, depending upon the function, either with an acquisition person or with a finance person, and you could step up and be a member of their team quickly, because what you'll be doing for that company won't be something that you're seeing for the first time. You will have seen it as part of our education process. Now, I don't have that strong of a feeling for how other programs approach it, so I think we're somewhat unique in the emphasis that we put on this. But I've been impressed with both the quality of the students, and I've been impressed with the jobs that they're getting afterwards, which tells me we must be doing something right.
I mean, do you like teaching? Do you want to get back into the business at some point?
You know, it's hard to say right now. I've only been out for, I guess this is about 6 months, and I'm spending about a third of my time on teaching. The chairman of the Federal City Council, which is a business group here that's intimately involved in trying to help sort out the mess with Metro. So I probably spend about a third of my time on that. And the other third of my time is related to, being on a board or two and working with the roundtable and NAREIT on some of these legislative issues. So right now I have a pretty interesting portfolio of activities. As I've described to some folks, I spent a lot of time dealing with the next earnings call, the next board meeting, the next something. And so much of my life ended up being caught up in the routine that while I loved it, I don't know that I need to do more of that. So now what I'm doing is focusing on the sorts of things that are interesting, they're challenging. It's still, a lot of what I'm doing is real estate related, but I have a little bit of the luxury now of picking what interests me as opposed to what I have to do. So for right now, that's perfect. I'm still young, still in pretty good shape, and you never know what might come next, but I'd certainly say for the rest of 2017, I think it's pretty clear what I'm going to spend my time on.
Fair enough. Well, if you're working with Metro, I mean, what are those emails like, man? I mean, goodness gracious.
The challenge that we have with Metro in Washington, D.C. is just, it's not something that's new. It's something that has grown over time. I mean, Dick White, the CEO of Metro 10 or 12 years ago, identified a lot of the issues that we're facing right now. Underinvestment in the system, a need to spend more time and more money on maintenance, being more thoughtful about just how the whole system operates, being more thoughtful about some of our labor agreements and things like that. And it's all slowly but surely building to a point where we had to go through SafeTrack, which involved, for folks outside of Washington, D.C., significant closures and restrictions on the system for over a 12-month time period. And while that caught us up to some degree, we're not done yet. So I think as we've analyzed this in conjunction with a number of the other business groups in the Washington, D.C. area, we think one of the most fundamental changes you have to make is to change the governance structure. Right now, you have essentially local politicians serving on Metro's board. And while I think they're great people and they're smart people and they want to do well, the reality is they end up with a dual fiduciary duty to their jurisdiction, who's electing them, and to Metro. And I think that's just a problematic structure. So we've been advocating that you need to change the governance, reduce the number of board members, Their only fiduciary duty is to Metro. Run it more like a corporate board and less like what it is. That should allow the system and the leaders of Metro to make better decisions, because they'll get more support from their board around sensible decisions for the system, as opposed to somebody worrying about running an extra bus line through an element of the area. And so that's, you know, we think if you can make that fundamental change, there then is an ability to affect change in how you operate the system and ultimately reduce costs, which will then allow us to invest more in the existing system and make certain it's well-maintained and safe, which is the most critical thing.
Ed, thanks so much. Really, it's been great having you here. Great hearing, everything that, you've been working on lately, as well as, looking back. It's been really interesting. Really appreciate you taking down time for us.
Well, it's been fun. Good way to spend Friday afternoon.
And thank you all for joining us, too. For The REIT Report, I'm Alan Kenny.